Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, there is Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Thank you, Brian.
And everyone's favorite substitute podcast host, it's Amanda Waltz.
Hi, guys.
I feel like that should have been followed by applause. I'm going to see if I can cut applause in there.
Do you have like a morning DJ sound machine?
I wish with every fiber of my being that I could find a way to play sound effects like over Skype while we were recording so that every once in a while I could just like drop an air horn or like a sad trombone. Just be like, it's Danny King. Bam, 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 bam.
Get one of the, aren't there ones that are shaped like a megaphone that have sound effects on them? You could do that.
Might be.
Yeah.
Might be.
And it's like, they make them for
Amanda
children.
Waltz from Pittsburgh.
Go to hell, Brian.
Today on the Film Stage Show, we will be talking about It Follows, the horror film that is sweeping the nation. Before that, we'll be actually doing a review of the newest short by Don Hertzfeldt of rejected cartoons fame, that is World of Tomorrow. Everyone at home, if you would like to, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, @filmstageshow. And you can also comment and give us a rating on iTunes or comment on this show on thefilmstage.com. Someone last week actually had something to say to us. You knew this was coming.
For the Run All Night podcast?
No, not for the Run All Night podcast, for the Fault podcast.
Oh, okay. What did they say?
Amanda thought that a song was written by Leonard Cohen.
No, I didn't. I already cleared this up.
I know, I saw it, but I'm bringing it up anyway.
By the way, Devin, thank you for listening.
Yes, Devin, thank you for listening. Thank you for being out there to keep us honest, keep us true.
No, I did not actually think it was Leonard Cohen. I thought that I actually thought the song was written for the movie, and it just sounded like a Leonard Cohen knockoff song.
I see.
But apparently it's an actual song by an actual person.
Yeah, Jackson C. Frank.
I don't know who that is.
I don't know either, but it's a damn good song for that movie. So hooray.
Why did you waste time? Precious time. To point that out.
This is a podcast. Time is not precious. We could we've gone on tangents about Russell Madness.
So. Okay, no. Moving away.
And getting back to what we're actually doing. So yeah, that's that. Let's get into it. Let's start talking about some movies. So the first thing we're going to talk about is a movie, a short film, animated, that premiered at Sundance. This is World of Tomorrow by Don Hertzfeldt. Again, who people may know as the guy who did the rejected cartoons. I think that's probably his most famous thing. Everyone has seen it on YouTube. And this is the point where I have to really hold back from just quoting that for 10 minutes. Also, Billy's Balloon, which is fantastic. Again, all these are on YouTube, so go check them out. He also did It's Such a Beautiful Day, which I talked about on this podcast not that long ago, actually. So World of Tomorrow, it's a really interesting little 16-minute short that is, in my opinion, 100% incredible.
Mm.
And it is about a young girl, maybe 3 or 4, who is actually brought into the future by a third-generation clone of herself to learn about the world of tomorrow. So let's talk about it briefly. Amanda, what did you think of this this short film?
I thought it was adorable. And I have a soft spot on my heart for any cartoon or any animated work that uses actual children to do a child's voice. And I think in this case, it's very, very charming. Just, you can tell that the little girl is just, I don't know. I doubt that they even gave her a script, because she's just going off on the typical 3-4-year-old babble. I think at one point she's talking about a snake boy.
Yeah.
because they're able to draw in the air, and her clone says, "I drew a snake boy," and she's like, "Ah," and she just goes off.
She just talks for like a full minute about why you can't always draw a snake boy.
It's really sweet. Yeah, and the animation is incredible. I love that. Anybody who can make stick figures an art form,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just incredible. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it.
To be fair, they're not holy stick figures.
Not
they have,
holy.
They have bodies. But I take your point.
Kind of like, kind of bodies.
Like a triangle to, to symbolize a dress.
Yes.
Yeah, the most rudimentary body work.
Oh, it's so great. Yeah, it's really, really charming.
All right, Danny King, what did you think?
Yeah, I really liked it as well. I have a friend who's an animator, and so he's the one who first introduced me to Hertzfeld stuff on YouTube, which was hilarious. And then I saw It's Such a Beautiful Day also, which sort of showed how close his style teeters between comedy and sort of sadness, which I think is also picked up in World of Tomorrow. I definitely agree with Amanda's point about the voice acting. I think that girl, from what I read, is his, Hertzfeld's niece.
Aww.
And he's sort of, I think she's like 4, and he just talked to her for like a week or something, and then recorded that stuff, I think, and then sort of shaped the dialogue to fit that stuff in. So that's pretty cool. And yeah, from her first line, you're sort of just like in the movie because of that.
Her first line is like, "I had lunch today."
Yeah.
After the clone has explained in detail about how she's going to live forever through her, through clones that have her memories loaded. She just says, "I had lunch today."
Yeah, the juxtaposition is so good.
That's like where nearly 100% of the humor comes from.
Yeah. And then, yeah, it was interesting to see him try to adapt his style to like a sci-fi story. I don't know all of his past work, but I assume this is sort of a leap in terms of genre, although I could be wrong, but it works really well for his like view of the future. The movie kind of starts very much with his like standard stick figure, like white background, and then becomes more and more complicated. And it was great to look at. And it's, you know, probably we'll watch it a couple more times, as I know Brian has done.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sure
this short took over my life this weekend, man.
Aww.
Why don't you talk about that? Talk about your weekend.
So I watched this on Friday night. I don't even remember. I can't even remember what I'd done before I watched this movie. I was watching it, and I mean, I love Don Hertzfeld, so I was pretty sure that I was going to be into it. But like, I didn't immediately turn around and watch "It's a Beautiful Day" or "It's Such a Wonderful," "It's Such a Beautiful Day" again. And but this movie, I was just immediately on board. It was like the perfect amalgamation of everything that I love about Hertzfeld, because he's got the kid in there, and he's really wonderful with like animating children. Like, there's something about his style that really fits, because it looks like a very childish style, and just the immediate difference between, there's this older woman with a semi-British accent talking to this incredible little girl who just doesn't really seem to understand what's going on, and the illustration of the future that they make, and the way that it's all teased out with such like a dark, beautiful humor, that when the movie was over, I just immediately watched it again, and then I watched it again, and then as I was laying in bed, I watched it again, and then when I woke up the next morning, I watched it again. And I really don't know by this point how many times I've watched this movie, because there's something so pure and perfect about it that it just keeps drawing me. Like, I'll just be like, "Oh, I gotta go get a haircut. I have like 20 minutes before I have to leave." Oh, okay, I'll just watch World of Tomorrow again. And it's so, there's like just everything about this is great. Like the animation style, the voice acting. There's something really interesting about the way that the older Emily in this movie says time travel.
Oh, yeah.
Like, time travel. It's just, it's so weird and so wonderful. And it just is like the most novel, beautiful thing ever. And there's these moments of like real resonant sadness in everything that's going on. And sometimes it just hits you like a brick, and then sometimes it makes you laugh your ass off. Like, when they're talking about how, like, the rich will use cloning technology to give birth to a younger version of themselves, and then upload their memories into that clone. But if you're not that affluent, you can just upload your digital consciousness into a cube. And when they talk about the cube, it's really subtle. You don't even realize it at first how much of a hellscape this cube must be, because she says that their grandfather's in a cube, that the cube, like, they can, in there they can read and like watch movies. And so she says that she uploads the newest films and books every once a week. But then you find out that an hour in the cube is perceived as 4 years worth of time, which means that I haven't done the math yet. But that's hundreds of years you're just in there alone before you suddenly get some more stuff. And the letter that they read from the cube is a thing of beauty.
So, Danny, you mentioned that your friend is an animator. And mm-hmm. My first boyfriend went to Edinburgh for animation. And my fiance's brother actually works in animation. And it seems like he is definitely revered in the animation community, and justly so. I mean, he's able to make, like I said, he's able to do this very simplistic seeming style and just imbue it with this, like you said, like tragicomic, like content. It's so, I don't know. It's just, I feel like it's very singular. I don't know if anybody else could do it as well as he can.
Yeah, and I mean, I think part of the inspiration is that he's just basically doing this in his house. So
yeah.
Like, and when you see his movies, like, the credits consist of him thanking a bunch of people and then just his name.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. And he also...
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was just going to mention that in his past films, I think he does the voices, so it's even... This film might be even a shift in terms of, like, his voice isn't in it at all. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can go on.
Oh no, I was just thinking, but I think I'm completely wrong. I'm not sure if he did Bambi versus Godzilla, but I don't think that he did.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah. I don't think he did, but for some reason, for a second, I thought maybe.
Mm-hmm. One thing I came across, cause I don't really watch The Simpsons, but I guess he did.
Oh yeah.
An intro to The Simpsons. That takes them into the future, so I watched that, and that seemed kind of crazy.
Yeah, it was it was pretty nuts. And he does the thing in the intro to The Simpsons that he does in a lot of his things, where he uses like really arch classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and in some of them it's for comedy, and in some of them it's for dramatic effects. And I have to say, every time the music kicked in this movie, it was like a sucker punch. It was amazing. Like the balloon ride across Mars. Like, just beautiful. Just amazing.
Yeah.
So, I could literally talk for 4 hours about this film.
Did you even see It Follows, Brian? Did you just watch it?
I was really hoping I could just hijack this podcast and make it only about World of Tomorrow. I did sit in a theater to see It Follows, but then I just kept watching World of Tomorrow over and over again.
Like, on your phone?
Yeah.
In the very back row?
Exactly. It was amazing.
Have you ever seen that Portlandia episode, the Battlestar Galactica?
Oh, yeah.
That was you.
Pretty much.
You didn't go to work.
I was late to go get a haircut. The great thing is that I could watch this at work, because I have, we got a Vimeo screener of this, and I downloaded it onto my phone.
Oh, wow.
Because Vimeo, the app, lets you do that, so you can watch things offline. So I was like, what happens if I'm not near a wireless connection? Like, I need to be able to watch this. I literally had the thought to myself, I'm flying to Houston on Wednesday. It's a 3-hour flight. I was like, oh, great, I'll be able to watch World of Tomorrow over and over again. Oh, my God. I'm a wreck, guys. This movie has destroyed me. It's pretty bad.
Was there anything left to destroy?
If you took this movie away from me, then yeah, I'd probably be more destroyed. This movie's the only thing propping me up. It's just, it's so good. It's so fucking good. It's like, and I love movies that function as like a perfect short story. That's one of the reasons I love The Gray and Enemy so much. And so this movie obviously just hits all those sweet spots.
For real.
And just like the little inventiveness of it, like the way it ends. I'm not going to say how it ends, but there's like a beat before the actual ending that's just like sad and wonderful, and it makes you, it, like, it stops your heart for a second, and then it's, I don't know, guys. This movie's perfect. It is literally currently my number one film of the year. I
can't wait until we have to do our top tens for 2015.
And my number one is World of Tomorrow.
I cannot wait for that.
I mean, I'm allowed to do that, right? This is a real concern of mine right now.
You can do whatever you want.
Do whatever the hell you want.
All right, good. It's my goddamn list. Yeah, no, if you follow me on Letterboxd, which is, I'm only using it like for the first time in earnest this year. And so I've been keeping a running list of where I rank everything that I've seen in 2015 that actually came out in 2015. And this is currently at the top. It's amazing. So any final things to say about World of Tomorrow?
I mean, we're almost 30 minutes into this podcast. And
we've literally been talking longer than the movie actually is. Yeah, no, my current number one is World of Tomorrow. My number two is Ballet 422, so...
I will catch up with that at some point.
You damn well better.
Yeah.
All right.
It's actually opening here in April, so...
Yeah, like I said on the last podcast, everyone should go see it. I actually need to follow up and harass Dan, who was our guest last episode, to make sure that he's watched it. Because if he hasn't, I'm going to beat him. That's it. Let's move on to our actual featured review. That is of the new horror film by David Robert Mitchell, and that is It Follows, which stars Micah Monroe, Keir Gilchrist, and Olivia Lucardi. So I did a weird thing with this movie. Jordan Raup, our esteemed editor-in-chief,
our master.
Magnanimous master of our universe, a couple months ago, actually, just told me, hey, that's a really good movie, you should see it. Now, this is something that I hear literally 10 times a day from numerous people, some of them who I like. It doesn't really matter to me who says something like that. I'll usually just find out things about the movie anyway, but for some reason, when Jordan Raup said It Follows is really good, you should go see it, it's flipped a switch in my brain that said, do not learn anything about this film. I think, like, between him saying that and then just seeing the poster that says It Follows and has, like, two people hooking up in a car, I was just like, don't learn anything about this movie. Nothing at all.
Interesting.
So I did a thing that I never do. I avoided the trailer. I avoided all spoilers. I left rooms if I heard people talking about this. I literally shouted at my friend the other week because he was talking about how he didn't like the movie that much, and I said, that's cool, I haven't seen it yet. And then he kept going on, explaining why he didn't like it, and finally I just said, dude, shut the hell up. I haven't seen it yet. I don't want to know anything about it. So I don't know what kind of mind virus Jordan implanted in me. But in case other people are struggling through the same mind virus as me, before we even talk about the plot of this movie, let's just say out loud, do we think people should go and see this movie? Danny King.
Yes.
Amanda Waltz.
Yes.
please don't add to that.
Okay, interesting inflection.
Is that all the review we're doing?
Maybe a bit of reticence in there.
That was such
a good...
Do you want
to qualify that yes?
I kind of wish Dan was here. That's all I'm going to say about that before I go into my actual review.
Okay, well, I'm going to say yes. So, three yeses. If you haven't seen It Follows, if you're just here to find out if you should, go see it. Now playing in theaters. It's coming to VOD later. The Weinstein Company actually pushed back the VOD release so they could open it wider and get more money. But yeah, that's that. So now we can actually, if you haven't seen it, if you're afraid of spoilers, just turn off the podcast and go out and see it. But let's talk about it in like actual critical analysis now, which is our job.
We used to daydream about being old enough to go on dates. I had this image of myself holding hands with a really cute guy, which driving along some pretty road. It's never about going anywhere, really. It's having some sort of freedom, I guess.
Jay, you awake?
What
are you? You're not going to believe me, and I need you to remember what I'm saying.
This thing, it's going to follow you. Somebody gave it to me, and I passed it to you.
Wherever you are, it's somewhere, walking straight for you. All you can do is pass it along to someone else.
I'm scared.
So It Follows is the story of a young girl named Jay, who after a sexual encounter with a boy that she has met, finds out that she has now been passed a curse, a haunting, if you will. I don't really know the best way to put it, but she is being followed by a malevolent force that will destroy her if it gets too close to her, and that her only hope for survival is apparently to sleep with someone else and pass on the curse. However, if that person is killed, the curse will then come after her. It Follows. Fantastic movie. Amanda Waltz, why don't you give us a little context behind the strange way in which you said yes.
So, it's not necessarily that I didn't... Okay, so I was underwhelmed by this movie, is what I should say.
Okay.
I didn't necessarily dislike it. I will say that in terms of, like, formally, it's really fantastic looking. It's beautifully shot. I think the cinematographer's name is, I think, Mike Gulakis. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, but he doesn't have a very impressive resume. I think the one movie he did, John Dies at the End, which is not a very good movie. even though I'm a big Don Casarelli fan, it did not work for me. So, you know, but his work on this movie is really great. There's a lot of great camera techniques. I enjoyed, there's like 360 pans and long takes, and the compositions of the shots are really fantastic. I really liked the group dynamic. I would say that this movie is sort of like, I don't know if it's sort of like Monster Squad if it was directed by Nicholas Winding Refn.
That is perfect. I love that.
It is very, because it's these teenagers who are Jay's, I think it's her sister, her kind of neighbor friend, and this guy who is also her friend but also has a crush on her, and they all are trying to help her out. And, you know, there are these like very strange ways that they come up with fighting this follower. Because I don't really know what else to call this thing, because it's not a ghost. It's not a monster. It's not really. It's just
like a spectral, invisible, malevolent presence.
Yeah, it's kind of like a. It's implied that it's an STD, kind of like sort a manifestation of an STD. I don't know. But
there's only one of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It is weird. There's definitely a way to read this, and I think it's difficult at first not to read this as an STD stand-in movie.
I think you could read it a couple different ways, but
I'm just saying the most apparent one is STD. And then you'd have to, gotta give it a second to find the other ones.
It's, I don't know, there's a lot of things about this movie that I have to unpack, so I'll just try to like sum up, just so I'm not totally dominating. But I just thought it was, I think what it is like, people are comparing this to 80s horror such as Friday the 13th, not Friday the 13th, Friday the 13th, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, is probably the most significant one. But I actually think that this is influenced a lot by J-horror, especially in the idea that you can't destroy the other, you can only live with it or pass it on, but it's always
it's a definite Ring type of scenario.
Yeah, it's definitely Ring. You know, it definitely plays against that Robin Wood formula of you know, getting back to normalcy by destroying the other. You will never get back to normalcy in this case. It's always going to be there, and which is a terrifying idea.
I actually love.
Yeah, and I love that. When I've seen it that in other films, I've loved it. And this one, I don't know what it was. It was just something about this movie that everything was there, but it just did not work for me. My fiance really liked it.
Oh boy.
And I kept goading him into explaining to me why he liked it, because I was like, am I missing something? Am I not seeing what's so great about this movie? But I don't know. It was kind of frustrating to me because I really wanted to like it, and I was just so completely just meh. But yeah.
Danny King, what about you? What did you think of It Follows?
Wow, that was pretty shocking, Amanda.
I know.
I was shocked.
Like I got the wind knocked out of me.
Kidding. I think the just a brief note, the J-horror comparison is really good. I can't remember which one now, but I read a review that brought that up in the context of having like that malevolent presence walking right toward the camera is just sort of so terrifying. Because this movie doesn't at all rely on jump scares, but the two or three of them that there are sort of use that, and it's pretty... It made me jump in my seat. But yeah, as for the movie overall, so the director, or I guess in terms of my anticipation, to go back to Brian's point, I had definitely read about this film when it was getting buzz at Cannes last year. So I've sort of known what it's about for a while, and I've been looking forward to it. So I guess we went into it with opposite information. But yeah, so the director, David Robert Mitchell, his previous film was called The Myth of the American Sleepover, which is not a horror film at all. Mm. But it has the same sort of retro, nostalgic kind of vibe with hanging out with teens. That movie's basically just an ensemble film of teens hanging out, also in Detroit, I believe. And so I find that really appealing. I think he gets really naturalistic performances, and the language feels real. And especially in this film, there's like a sort of nagging stasis with these characters just sort of sitting in yards or their rooms and not really moving forward at all in their lives outside of the horror plot. I just really enjoy that, the way he captures that atmosphere. Specifically in terms of horror, I think it's definitely influenced by Carpenter, like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the last time someone shot Suburbs this way. Those shots that just sort of move forward as they're in cars and the houses just rush by. I find that very powerful. But yeah, I have to agree with one point, which is that the sexual politics confuse me.
Yeah.
Because I love the idea of his retro kind of romantic view of teen life. But the two things that two of the main events in this movie are, one, if you have sex with the wrong person, you get someone coming after you all the time. And two, there's a very strong subplot where it's like, maybe this girl will get better if she just hooks up with like her true love or her childhood love. And so both of those ideas seem weirdly conservative. And
I don't really, is that?
Well,
I mean, that's,
I think I
don't know if I agree with that reading. We'd have to get into spoilers.
Yeah, that's why I was. It. Yeah, that's why I was sort of.
Yeah, and I think I went into this movie thinking it was going to be this rich commentary on this. I don't know. Maybe if I went into this movie with high expectations, I think I was thinking I was going into it with this idea that it was going to confront the idea that women don't have control over their own bodies, and kind of, and when they do assert control over their own bodies and their own sexuality, they're punished for it. Because, but then you have the male element in there, because Hugh/Jeff is also haunted by it, So then I was like, well, maybe it's this idea that the burden of sex is always on the woman. So it's always
just that sex is not a destination.
Okay.
I mean, like, that's kind of what it felt like to me. I mean, she even has a moment where she's in the car right after they've had sex. And it's funny because that whole scene is shot like it's her losing her virginity.
Mm-hmm.
But then we find out later that she's been having sex since high school.
Is she in college?
I believe that she is.
Okay.
Like a really, really shitty college.
Yeah.
Like a real shitty college. mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think she's like 18.
Okay, like, yeah, that's
and
fair.
She, but at some point she says, like, I've had sex with this guy once in high school and it wasn't a big deal. So it's like, it's weird how it kind of plays on that and then doesn't even make a big deal about the fact that she isn't a virgin. Because I think that's actually one of the most powerful things about the film is the fact that it doesn't delineate between losing virginity and having sex with a person for the first time.
Yeah, because it's very blasé about, oh yeah, I'm dating this guy. We're going to maybe hook up. I don't know. Yeah. It actually treats it as it's not a big deal, which in the trailers, I kind of felt like it was hinting that, oh, she is a virgin and this is a big deal, but it's not at all.
And it kind of forces you to examine your own prejudices because the way she dresses in the movie isn't conservative, but it's just the kind of dressing up that you think in a movie, like, oh, this is like virginal symbolism.
Like, it's very strange,
like a kind of lacy pink dress that goes all the way up to the neck and it doesn't reveal a lot, and you're just like, oh, okay, she's a virgin. And it's like, wow, way to slut shame. Like, you know, you see a girl who's not dressed like right. Well, it was one of those things where it's like, well, she's dressed like this, so that must mean that she's a virgin. And I was just like, I don't know. It definitely made me examine the way that you take nonverbal cues and like costume cues and action cues from a movie to assume about characters and maybe apply that to real life.
Well, and it is because it's, and I actually really appreciated a lot of the outfits in this movie because they were very childish, but yet they definitely had this vibe of they were revealing but not sexy. It was strange because there's even that scene where her sister's on that beach and she's wearing these knee-high what look like knit socks and shorts and a bandeau top and a bandeau swim top, and it just looks so, I really wanted to know.
I'm glad that you know the actual term for that top, because I would have just been like, it's, you know, one of those ones that just goes around.
This is what I do.
Hooray.
This is what I bring to the table.
Bandeau. I'm going to have to write that down.
Yeah, it's...
Work that into the lexicon.
I really would love, and I will say, I would love to interview... I actually looked up who the costume designer was. I would love to interview the woman who did the wardrobe for this movie, because I really thought that the choices were motivated, because it sort of teeters between being too sexual and too girly. I don't know. It's really... Because even the... Like you said, she's wearing that lacy pink dress, but then she's wearing this puka shell, this big chunky puka shell necklace and this big Sherpa coat. And
I gotta say, though, that was doing it for me.
All right, Brian.
No, I'm like,
easy there.
I'm 100% with you, because there's in most films, there's a tendency to, you either age someone up or you age someone down, or you can age them down as a means of sexualizing them. And this movie, everything felt very strange and natural, and like you said, it skirts that line.
Yeah, and I really appreciated that, because I felt like that was one of the elements of this movie that really worked, is the, you know, and I think that there's, if you ever watch like other horror movies, there's this, I don't know, I think it was kind of motivated a little bit by like 80s wardrobe, or I don't know, like 80s style a little bit, but not, I don't know. And that's the other thing about this movie.
It takes place in no specific time.
It takes place in no specific... I was so confused as to what time this movie is supposed to take place.
There was literally a point where I said, oh, we're in the future.
Well, because it takes place in Detroit. It's in Detroit. So...
Which is like second only to Pittsburgh in post-apocalyptic cityscapes.
I don't even know why I bother. How dare you? But it, and this is something that my fiance and I were talking about, because I had no idea what time this is supposed to take place. And he said, it's in present day. And I was like, okay, it's in present day. But there's that, the one thing that really confused me was the seashell e-reader.
The seashell e-reader. What the hell is that?
Which, number one,
yeah,
where do I get one? Number two, that shit is straight out of like a George Saunders story. That it was one of the strangest things I've ever seen in a movie. Because, and I read the interview that I think Jordan did for the Film Stage with David Robert Mitchell, and he asked him point blank about the seashell e-reader, and the guy said, well, we wanted something that didn't look like a droid and didn't look like an iPhone. It looked like you couldn't really connect it with like a particular, I think he said like a particular time or culture. And I was like, yeah, but a seashell e-reader?
Yeah.
Really?
Like, that's, and then she's the only one who seems to have an e-reader.
It's so strange.
She legitimately seems like a traveler from another world.
Yeah. Oh, and I love that. The ultimate precocious teen, Yara, who I loved.
She was pretty awesome. I won't lie.
I love the scene where Jay goes to the park and they follow her there, and they turn around and Greg, the sort of neighborhood, I guess he's supposed to be like the neighborhood bad boy, is walking towards them, and she says, do you see him? And Yara just goes, it's a person. I laughed so hard at that line. But yeah, I loved Yara. But yeah, it is like, because there's all these old cars and all the furnishings, it's as if this movie hasn't, or this suburb hasn't progressed since, I would say, what's that Michael Moore movie?
Columbine.
No, the first movie he...
Yeah, but...
Mike and Me, Mary and Me, Something and Me.
Oh my God, this is terrible that we don't know this.
Roger and Me.
There we
Roger
go.
Roger and Me. But it's like, so this movie never progressed after the fall of the automobile industry in Detroit. It just seems so strange. And it's also about, it's also plays on the idea that the suburbs will just keep you safe.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like the suburbs are just as run down as the blighted urban areas that you see in a lot of the driving sequences. And
yeah, the only truly nice place they go is Jeff/Hugh's house.
Yeah. Which he kind of lives in a cul-de-sac.
You know those cul-de-sac dwellers.
You know. Well, it is, because it's the difference between, I think they live in like the old suburbs, mm-hmm, and he lives in the new cookie cutter suburbs.
Right.
So it's kind of, I feel like it's depicting a lot of these different hierarchies of where people live and the idea of suburbs, and I don't know.
So we're talking a lot about the art and the themes and everything. Let's just, can we break it down? This movie scared the shit out of me. Like, this is a horror film. We should definitely talk about its effectiveness. I was tense throughout this whole film. It was a nightmare.
It was very disquieting.
Yeah.
I will say, from the very beginning, it's very disquieting.
Oh my God. That whole first scene that takes place in like a single shot. And this is another thing. I love it when a movie really makes geography clear. And this movie does it in the simplest way possible, which is just sometimes the camera pivots on a single point and gives you like a 360 degree view of what's going on. And it's amazing. And I also love the fact that this movie variably will give you, because no one can see what's following these people except for people who have the curse, or the I guess it's a curse, we'll just call it a curse. They never call it a curse, they don't really call it a lot of things, so don't think that we're representing the movie, because one of the things I like about it is how obtuse it is, but mm-hmm, only they can see it, which makes it even weirder, because when there is like a 7-foot tall man coming after you, and he walks right by your friends and they don't see him at all, that shit is terrifying. And these people, they're not dressed like normal people. Some of them are completely naked. Some of them are soaking wet. Some of them are covered in blood and just have like a half shirt on. And it's just terrifying.
That woman that I, One of the reviews I read said that urine was pouring out of her. I think she was supposed to be like a drowned cheerleader, the one in the kitchen.
I think so.
That was the one moment that unnerved me quite a bit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had a couple of moments that unnerved me. And the other thing is that because this thing can either be a horrifying monster from a hellscape or just a normal little boy, it can be anything. It's really hard to tell in a scene if a person is in trouble or not, because people just walking along could be they could just be normal people. And and the fact that the movie kept switching perspective helped to heighten the terror involved in it. I was so unnerved and I was so uncomfortable. And my friend that I was watching this with, I'm pretty sure I saw her covering her eyes at certain points or like holding her face. And it was just, oh my God, it was like a nightmare in the best way possible, because it's a horror movie.
See, I think that was my biggest issue with the movie, is that I felt the exact opposite, where it's implying that you won't know what this thing is when it's coming at you. Won't know that it's coming for you because it will take on the shape of a normal person. It'll take on the shape of a loved one. But she always knows that it's the follower whenever, like, the old woman shows up in the beginning. And even when, and that's, I was really looking forward to seeing how they play with the idea of, oh, it'll take on the form of a loved one. But then even when it takes on the form of someone that she knows that's what it is. And I felt like that was kind of a missed opportunity, because I was looking forward to her seeing someone coming toward her and just being like, oh, it's my sister.
Yeah,
but then she always knows that and I felt like, okay, this is not, I felt like that was kind of a missed opportunity in a lot of ways.
I kind of liked that it didn't do that, though, because what scared me about this thing wasn't the uncertainty, it was the inevitability.
Yeah, and I understand that.
So, like, but, and the old woman at the school, like, at first she's like, she doesn't really know. And then there are times when you can see it and no one even seems to realize it's coming.
Oh, like when it takes on, was it Yara? I think at one point it takes on the form of Yara.
Oh, yeah, when it's
nobody sees
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, that was the other thing about this movie that I think lost me, was the scenes where they actually, because he says, don't let it touch you, when he explains to her that how it works. And the initial confrontation at the lakeside house, where it walks up to her and it just pulls her hair, and then you see what's his face, Paul, get hit by a chair and you don't see it. I just thought it was comical. I didn't think it was scary. I was like, so it's just gonna pull her hair, that's it? And
well,
then
I mean, obviously it was gonna do something more to her, but I think it was pulling her hair to like get her out of the chair to then take her out.
I don't know.
The mechanics of how this thing kills you seem to change, which is another thing that scares me.
Well, yeah, because there is that, even when she, because it goes, even the scene where it's in the kitchen, I think it's implied that, oh, it's just going to keep coming straight for you. It's not going to stop. But she goes into the kitchen and I'm like, has it been standing in there waiting for her to come into the kitchen and see it?
Well,
why is it not coming after her?
It could have taken a bit to climb in the window.
Maybe. I think it didn't have any arms, if I recall. But anyway, yeah, I think that was my kind of, I just had a few issues with this movie.
No, I didn't. I was too busy being frightened.
I wasn't scared.
Danny, were you scared at all during this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, there we go. None of us are as badass as Amanda, apparently.
I'm a horror nerd. I've been desensitized.
Horror movies don't usually scare me. Like, it's this and The Descent.
Oh, The Descent, the monsters didn't scare me.
No,
the idea of being buried alive.
No, The Descent is like a great horror movie premise, because first you're terrified because they're like squeezing through rocks and caves, and I'm not cool with that shit at all. And then the monsters come and you just like break in half. It's like the tension has been ratcheting, and now you're just going to throw a fucking monster in it? Seriously? No, not cool, guys.
Yeah.
Not cool at all. Oh my god, the trolls.
I actually had to the first time I saw that movie, I actually had to turn it off and get up and go catch my breath. Like, I had to go outside and remind myself that I was in an open space.
I watched that movie in college with a friend of mine who said, "Oh, this is going to scare the shit out of you." And I didn't believe him. And oh my god. I drank literally half a bottle of whiskey while watching that movie to try to calm down.
To try and calm down, or just because you wanted to drink?
Well, obviously, I would be drinking during it anyway, but my drinking was a lot heavier because I was terrified. But back to It Follows. Anything we want to say before we get into spoilers?
Danny, I feel like we dominated this conversation. I wish you'd say more.
Yeah, let me try to think.
Well, I was going to actually turn it over to Danny when we got into spoilers, because the thing that he said that I've been most interested and eager to talk about is the question about getting rid of the curse in the way that Danny thought it was.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely looking forward to you saying that and then me tearing you apart.
But I'm on your side still. You know?
Yes. Excellent.
I'm the lone dissenting opinion, I guess.
Yeah, fuck you.
Oh, jeez. I knew this was going to be rough.
If only Dan had been here to defend you.
So I stayed up to 2 in the morning doing research to form my arguments.
Really?
Because I knew this was going to happen. I knew I was going to be the one person, and I was like, I got to come up with a good argument. Oh, man.
So where's this good argument? Is it coming out in spoilers?
I think I'll just... Because then I can talk without with abandon.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised we've spent this much time not in spoilers.
Okay, so, let's get into it.
Let's do that. This is spoilers. I've already spoiled some stuff, but we're gonna get to the big stuff now. So spoilers, everyone, go away, run away, see this movie. Danny King, please walk us through, because you said that the gender politics were weird, because she had to sleep with the boy that she was actually in love with and who actually loved her to get rid of the curse.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not even that concrete, because, I mean, the main impression was just that, so while I was watching this movie, I was wondering how it was going to end, you know, how will she get rid of it, or will it end with sort of like a Carrie-type ending, you know?
Yeah.
And so the main plot thread that the movie seemed to be building to was the main character hooking up with her best friend. That's sort of like hinted at throughout as a narrative through line. And so when that impression alone sort of puzzled me, combined with the sort of potentially STD type like reading that we talked about earlier, where if this story is building to a point where if she just sleeps with her best friend, then the movie will end happily. That seemed like a not an entirely satisfying idea. But I don't even know if that's how it ended. Like, isn't the thing still there at the end?
That is the question. Okay. I don't believe that it is.
Okay. You think it's gone?
I think it's gone.
Okay.
Well, because there's so many moments where I think it's the idea of, in order for us to stay alive and stay together, we have to sleep with other people. And they're happy with that. I guess they're happy with that arrangement because they just keep having to sleep with people who I'm guessing they're not telling them what this thing is. Like, they don't give them the luxury that Hugh/Jeff gave Jay.
Yeah, can we just, like, let's stand up for Hugh/Jeff, because that guy...
Yeah.
I mean, dude... Horrifying plan, but a plan that works.
Yeah,
he's a stand-up guy.
He was a nice guy. I guess. In the world of this movie. But yeah, he tells her in detail how to deal with this thing. I'm going to make an assumption that Paul and
Jay
are not telling any of their victims that what this thing is. So I feel like that's sort of ineffective because they're just going to keep dying and this thing is just going to keep coming back. because she goes. I think it's implied that she goes out into that boat in one scene and just sleeps with all three of those guys
just to buy herself some time.
Yeah,
because
and he's
it's weird because they don't really telegraph what the time changes like, but you do see that the pool is empty in her backyard and broken down.
Yeah,
so I'm assuming that she slept with one of those guys and then that bought her like a month or two.
Oh, so it's like fall and they have to and it's I think it's just one of those things where I did appreciate about this movie is that there were sex scenes, but they were very tasteful.
Yeah,
like she's wearing her bra in one. It's not overly sexual, and they didn't show the scenes
even
with
her underwear isn't sexual.
Yeah, it's there. Like, I think she's wearing basically like almost like underoos.
I was about to say underoos, like half bloomers. Like it's really like sports shorts. Like, it's really
they were like there's like, a name boy shorts.
You could
they're wearing like boy shorts.
But boy shorts. Well, I'm not gonna claim to know everything about women's underwear. But boy shorts are usually still like form fitting, aren't they?
They were pretty form-fitting. I mean, you just but they were like lacy and pink. They were still
they are lacy and pink. But let me, if I saw a girl on a track running around in a sports bra and those bottoms, I'd be like, all right, that's fine.
Yeah,
I'm not seeing anything weird.
We are really talking about the underpants.
Now look, let's talk about the white underwear that she wore when she was in the bathroom.
Oh, so that was the other thing. Is she also does she also have a physical side effect?
I think no.
Because she's looking down at her crotch, and she starts hyperventilating, and I'm like, so does she have crabs, too? What? What is this?
Jeff, we can forgive the curse because you were a man about it and you told her about it, but the crabs, really.
Dude, the crabs, come on.
No, I think she was just, I mean, she had just been through a rape kit and a really weird sexual experience. I think she was just wondering or uncertain, and I don't know, it's weird.
Yeah, but I thought that scene was very strange.
Like, you know, the two guys that she, or every guy that she sleeps with doesn't make a mention of like, hey, why is there blah blah blah. I'm not even gonna try to make a joke there. So here's how the movie ends, since we're talking about it now. They come up with a plan after she has slept with the bad boy across the street, Greg, and he has been killed. Which is really fucked up. That they're going to go to this giant indoor pool. And this is actually, I was watching this and I was like, guys, this is a great plan. I love this plan. It kind of reminded me of an episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark? But I liked it. So, and the best thing is that because the time period in this is so uncertain, they're actually using older technology that doesn't have like an automatic kill switch on it, which I liked. So They're gonna ring this pool with electronic devices, get the thing to go into the pool, and then zap it. And then it starts throwing shit at her.
Yeah, that was the thing too, where it's assumed that this thing just will automatically follow her, and because it just doesn't think.
Oh,
so
but it thinks all right.
That thing, so it does think, and it's manifested as her father too in that scene.
Yeah, very subtly.
Yeah.
Very subtly.
So I feel like that.
At least he wasn't naked.
Oh no.
That would have been weird.
Would it?
Oh my god! You want to know something great?
What?
Speaking about how scary this movie is, I'm on a Mac, so I can see when people text me. It pops up on my screen. My friend Caitlin just said, so did you have any nightmares last night? Because I definitely had nightmares last night. And she is the one that I went and saw this movie with. So there's a ringing unawares endorsement. This movie will give you nightmares. But yeah, so the creature starts throwing things at her. And of course, at first, someone's like, oh man, it didn't work. But of course, like, it's throwing things at their friend who's in the pool. And so I think it was Yara who said, yeah, thank God.
I love Yara.
And so,
who I think is perpetually high throughout this movie because she is always eating.
She totally seems like it.
She's so great.
She's like surrounded by chips the entire time.
Like chips and Twizzlers. That's what she subsists on.
Damn right.
Is she the one that gets shot?
Yeah.
That's brutal.
That was the other funny thing.
She seemed pretty cool about it.
Yeah, no,
the first time they shoot at this creature, I'm like, oh god, they're gonna kill Greg, and then they don't. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's fine. And then the second time they're shooting at it, I'm not even thinking about that anymore. And poor little Yara gets a bullet in the leg. That's the other great thing, is that you can hurt this thing by shooting it.
But it just, it only stops it for a second. Which I, that was
more
the other thing, too.
More effective than a chair, though.
So he shoots it, and then she crawls over to the pool, and the pool's filling up with blood.
Yes.
So what is that? I don't know either. I guess that is one of the things about this movie is it's, well, that's the thing. Okay. That's the other thing about this movie is that it is so, it doesn't show you at all, or it doesn't pander to you at all about this thing in terms of,
they don't go to a library and learn about it.
Yeah. You can't go to a library and learn about it. It's this unstoppable force that is just going to keep pursuing you until it destroys you. And it's just going to go down the line, I guess, until it destroys the first person who had it. And nobody knows who that is.
That person might not even be alive anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So it's this thing that's been like passed down. But the other, but so it's so, like you said, obtuse about what this thing is and how you're going to kill it. And nobody knows how to kill it or how to get rid of it.
It's all just speculation and hope.
Yeah. So it doesn't pander to you in that regard, but I felt like it definitely pandered. This movie definitely pandered, and it was sort of condescending in the actual like commentary, the actual sort of like, because it's obviously about, oh, the suburbs aren't going to keep you safe. You know, you're.
Yeah. There's a time when they talk about that, like how they weren't allowed past 8 Mile because
past 8 Mile
suburbs ended.
And I was like, did you really have to do that movie? Did you really just have to explain to us what this movie is really about?
I didn't have a problem with that.
I did.
Jesus Christ.
I hate when movies explain the subtext. That bothers the shit out of me.
That also goes into what it's talking about with like childhood into adulthood.
Yeah.
Which is like, these people are now able to literally just drive around for fucking days and no one seems to give a shit because their parents are really messed up.
No parental guidance in this movie whatsoever.
This movie is like the failure of adulthood to deliver on its promises.
But
both
I feel
in,
like...
Both in like, their parents have stopped giving a shit
or
have stopped caring. And then these kids are growing into adulthood and they finally get to this milestone that is sex and they're still being pursued by death.
And
which is what I saw.
I think that's
something,
the whole idea of adults and male authority figures not being able to protect you and failing you, and the whole idea of like the suburbs aren't going to keep you safe has been explored in other movies. And I think even, I don't think it's a new idea. And that's kind of the other thing about this movie where I'm like, this has been done. I don't know. The whole idea of, I'm kind of sick of the whole thing about the whole, dark side of the suburbs, or, oh, the suburbs aren't really.
But this isn't, I don't think it lays on the suburbs as much as you think it does.
Oh, I did. It's super heavy handed.
Danny, do you agree?
Remember,
we're on the same side.
Yeah, no, we are. I didn't mind that so much just because the fear of the suburbs to me was communicated more through the form than like these lines of dialogue. Like I just, haunted by all the camera movement, this kind of goes back to my larger opinion of the film, which is like, I preferred when it's at its most oblique because then you can just watch it and enjoy the style. And that's sort of like the main, quality of it is like, it's really just an amazing command of widescreen framing and camera work. And so when you're not caught up in like thinking about the subtext, for me, it's the most enjoyable. And so some of those lines of dialogue didn't really register that strong with me because that's not really what I was like interested in, I guess.
It's also like for me, those lines were illustrative of, we used to be afraid of places and things, but like what we should really be afraid of is just the ever encroaching peril of death. like I said, this movie, it's the inevitability more than anything else that really does it for me. Like this thing. And it's not even like running towards them. It's not flying. It's just fucking walking.
Yeah, and I think that plays into...
Like, that is a terrifying thing.
Because it's definitely a Mike Myers type of this unkillable entity that is just going to keep pursuing you. What?
I thought you meant, like, Austin Powers.
Oh, he's never going to go away.
So you said this Mike Myers unkillable thing, and I was like, is she talking about...
Sorry,
Will
am I supposed to say Michael Myers?
Where you can't, like... Where you can't shoot him enough times to kill him. Yeah, Michael Myers would be a lot better.
Are you supposed to say Michael Myers? You're not supposed to say Mike Myers?
It's not Mike Myers. It is
Michael
Myers.
Me and Michael Myers were close. That's why I can call him Mike.
Mike. We could call him Mick. Shout out to Fultz.
Oh, jeez. But yeah, it is that sort of holdover from the Reagan era of you're going to get punished for... You know, doing drugs and having sex.
But I don't
think
it's a punishment. I think it's just...
No. I'm saying...
It is.
But it is... I think it's playing on that idea of even when it's completely innocent or even when it's, you know... I don't know.
But this movie's just about, for me, mortality and the ever-looming specter of your immediate death. I mean...
You had a very existential weekend, didn't you?
I did.
Between this and...
Look, here's what you really gotta do. You gotta watch World of Tomorrow 7 times, and then you gotta watch It Follows, and then you gotta watch World of Tomorrow again, and it all makes sense.
And then you just lay down and wait.
Just wait to die. Wait for it. Nothing you do matters. Even if you clone yourself a bunch of times, sooner or later death will find you. Motile deterioration.
Wonderful.
So they maybe kill this thing in the pool. He and Paul and Jay have sex. And as Danny said, Paul's kind of like the sweet guy that they actually have feelings for one another. And the best part is that Paul does what I thought of immediately, which is you got to have sex with someone who's going to have sex with a lot of people. And so he goes and finds a prostitute.
Yeah, I thought that was really clever. I did.
Right. That was my first thought. It was just like, go have sex with a porn star or a prostitute. You know,
we don't want to wipe out the whole porn star community, though.
Then we'd really be pushing a conservative message. But the thing is, and you don't know if it's still around, like, because this thing can be hurt, but it can't be stopped. But they like shoot it full on in the brain and in a pool. And maybe that has something to do with it. Like maybe there's something about water. Like, I don't know. But they're walking hand in hand and there's someone following them, but they're on a street. Where people walk.
And it's eerily peaceful.
Yeah.
Yeah. For real.
And it's like, and also it seems to me that everyone who's following, every time it manifests itself, the person is dressed wholly in white or not at all. And the person in the background, if I remember, seemed to be wearing color.
That's a good observation.
Why, thank you.
Yeah. Oh,
I was so terrified in this movie that I was like, there's got to be a tell. Like, otherwise, every scene is going to be goddamn unbearable for me.
Well, and that is, I think that's what's so great about the cinematography and the composition, because there's so many wide shots where you're just looking for this thing that could possibly be coming.
Again, the inevitability. It's never a jump scare, really, with this thing, except for like one time when they're peering through the hole in the door. But even that, it was hard to be a jump scare because you fucking know it's out there.
And I will say, because I know that you, and this is something that, and you guys keep saying jump scare, and I know that this is something that a lot of reviews I read is praising this movie for not using jump scares, not using gore, not using sort of the tropes. But I see.
Look, why don't you go back to your Saws and your Hostels? And leave real art to the heavy thinkers.
I will say I do like, and I read this Mark Harris piece for Grantland that was one of the components of my research. But and then he says that this movie, that this indie horror boom that's going on right now, which I think is sort of a backlash against the early 2000 torture porn horror, which was a very rough time. Says that now horror isn't interested in scaring you, so it's this movement of non-horror, which I thought was a pretty weak argument, but
I was about to say, that's what you brought to the table to try to defend
yourself?
Well,
no, I don't agree with it, but I don't agree with it, but I think the reason people are making that assumption that, like, oh, it's these, and the other two examples he used were Spring and Backcountry, and Spring is the, I think
we're going to talk about Spring in a couple weeks, actually.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about
right
that in Backcountry.
Fast 7.
Yeah, I want to see Backcountry.
But I think the reason he's saying, oh, it's non-horror because it doesn't have all these tropes of horror, because it doesn't have the jump scares and the gore and blah, blah, blah.
It's possible to scare without that stuff in it.
It is, but I don't think that you should praise a horror movie just because it's avoiding these tropes. And right. I think that, to me, is kind of what's going on with It Follows, where it's like, oh, it's great because it doesn't use all these cliches.
I'm not saying it's great because it doesn't use the cliches. I'm saying it's right. great and it doesn't use those cliches. And it totally does. There's like jump scares in this movie that are the most egregious kind of jump scare, because it's just some shit happening.
But I think it's like, I think people who approach this movie with that argument, I'm like, that's setting a very low bar for the genre.
Right.
It's saying, hey, as long as you avoid these tropes, you're good. But that doesn't necessarily mean...
It still has to scare you, though.
Yeah, it still has to scare you. And the whole idea of like, oh, these horror movies aren't interested in scaring you, and falls into that category.
I think this movie's obsessed with scaring you.
I don't think it's...
This movie has the perfect scare because it's the classic it's right behind you scare. There's like the scene at the beach was fucking horrifying.
That shit was comical. Sorry.
No way. No way.
I laughed at that.
And then when they're at the school learning about Hugh Jeff, and like you see the thing, and I was pretty sure that was the thing coming at them, and like this camera does the revolution. And then they're leaving the office. I'm like, where is it now? Because it's not moving that fast, but it could still be there. Oh my god, it's horrifying. It's ridiculous. It's terrifying.
I'm not saying that there aren't things in this movie that there are things in this movie that do work. I will say that.
When she was in the hospital, I was like, get out of the hospital. You don't know how long you've been unconscious for. It could be right there.
I did think that too, I'll admit.
Oh my god.
I just don't think it's the unrelenting nightmare that everyone is sort of pumping it up to be. I don't know, hyping it up to be. I don't know. This didn't scare me, you guys.
That's fine. All right. Well, we've been talking about this for quite a bit.
Okay.
So we should wrap it up. Danny King, any final thoughts?
Man, how about that first body?
Oh my
god. Twisted leg.
Beautiful.
That was like,
cut.
Do you guys watch Hannibal?
Yeah.
No.
That looked like something out of Hannibal.
Hannibal, there would have been a lot more to it, but yeah, I know what you mean. Just like
it's just that artful, it looked like
composition on a
I'm
beach.
Put it like back like this, and I'm gonna.
I love Hannibal.
Oh my god, I love it so much.
Okay, we can be friends again.
Yay! Boo!
Jesus. So yeah, Hannibal coming back to NBC this fall. Actually,
that was summer.
I was about to say actually this summer. Damn it. All right. Well, anyway, this episode brought to you by Hannibal on NBC this summer. yeah, great. I love this movie. This was good. This is a good time.
It's horrifying. Complicated. But... It is complicated for me.
Yeah. I see that. It sounds complicated. I hope one day that you can wrestle with your feelings with this enough to realize how wrong you are. No, you have made good points. And again, with a horror movie, it's very subjective. If you aren't scared by it, it's not a good horror movie.
I was disappointed that I wasn't as excited about it. And I know Jordan's probably going to be heartbroken that I...
Yeah, he's going to kick you off this now.
Oh, I did. But there were things about it. And I will say one more thing about the... Because you guys are talking about Paul. And my fiance, he's much more sartorial than I am.
The word sartorial.
He's much more clothes focused, I guess. But he pointed out that Paul's outfit change throughout the movie, he sort of became older and more adult, because it starts out he's wearing sort of just like this, like, you know, boyish outfit, and then as the movie progresses, I think it ends with him, like, he's wearing a jean jacket kind of like Greg wore,
yeah,
and then he ends with like wearing a leather jacket, so it's like, oh, Paul's like a big boy now.
Spends a lot of time in pajama pants too.
Yeah.
Everyone else in that is like dressed kind of okay, and he's like, ugh, I gotta stick around these fucking pajama pants.
Speaking of which, there are a lot of, because there's those scenes where he's spending the night. There are a lot of Afghans in this movie.
So many Afghans.
There's so many. Anyway, let's move on.
I'd also like to just do a shout out to the music.
Oh yeah.
That was like one of the things that in the moment I loved the most. Like that first scene when the music kind of starts off slowly and then like builds up to that crazy shuddering percussion heavy. I was like, oh, if this is the music that's gonna play in this movie, I'm fucking done. Like I'm totally just gonna break in half.
Yeah.
And the synths are a little nuts.
I'm not as fascinated by the whole John Carpenter electronic music.
Oh my god, you're so above everything, aren't you?
I'm just not into it, you guys.
Anyway.
Are you just too cool or what? Like, what's the problem?
I just don't see the fascination.
I don't understand your statement. It's good music. I'm not fascinated by it, and in most movies it would annoy the shit out of me.
I would say people are very fascinated by it, because it's sort of... Because now it's the John Carpenter-esque music in this movie that everybody's losing their shit over. I don't get it. Okay. Just gonna say it.
Well, today we're going to do what's coming out to Blu-ray really quick, and then we're each just going to name and briefly talk about a movie that we saw on our own, and then we're going to go. So, coming to Blu-ray, Interstellar. Great. See it.
Christopher Nolan's latest film.
Yep. Get the Blu-ray DVD, and you get a cell from the 70mm IMAX. I don't know if that does anything for people. Along with Interstellar, we're also getting a Diamond Lux Edition re-release of Gravity, I guess because space begets space. Wild also coming to Blu-ray. The Imitation Game coming to Blu-ray. There's a Dario Argento 3-pack that does not involve Suspiria, so why even bother?
Oh.
Yeah, right? No, wait, do you not like Dario Argento?
No, I'm just surprised that they wouldn't put Suspiria in there. Okay. I really like Suspiria.
All right, good.
Can I say, do you have more?
I was going to say Hoop Dreams and Cries and Whispers also coming out.
I have a shout out, Brian.
Shout it out.
So Shout Factory is releasing a 3-disc box set of The Decline of Western Civilization, which is which I have never been able to find streaming or otherwise. And it's basically 3 movies that it's by Penelope Spheeris, who I think she directed Wayne's World, but she made these 3 documentaries about these 3 different music eras, which was punk, metal, and I believe hardcore. I didn't see the 3rd one, but I saw the 2nd one, and they are fantastic. And if the other 2 are anything like this movie, which they probably are, I'm really, really looking forward to it. So watch out for that.
Hmm.
Sorry.
Sounds good.
All right.
I went a little long on that one.
Yeah, it's fine. Did any of us see Wild?
Yeah, I saw that.
Worth picking up?
I mean, I wouldn't, buy the Blu-ray, but it's pretty good.
Okay. I'm going to give a shout out to Interstellar. I think everyone should pick that up. Great movie. Yeah. Loved it.
There's a movie called Night Game that sounds fascinating.
Okay.
That stars Roy Scheider. And the synopsis is a police detective tracks a serial killer who is stalking young women on a beachfront after each game that a baseball pitcher wins.
Wow, that sounds...
And the poster is a baseball with a claw through it.
What? This is amazing. What is this called again?
Night Game? I kind of like want to watch it right now.
All right.
That sounds silly as hell.
That is... Oh my god, I just found it. It is amazing looking.
I will watch that.
Good lord. All right, so that's that. Next week we'll be talking about Furious 7.
So looking forward to it.
Right? Oh my god. So excited. Oh my god. If you, ladies and gentlemen at home, are not a fan of the Fast and Furious franchise, you can just take next week off, because holy shit, I'm so excited for this. We're not going to talk
about... Are you excited for it?
Well, I was going to either mention it today or next week. Totally down to see the movie, but I have very little experience with the franchise.
Oh my god, do not watch any of the movies. I want you to come into this cold.
Okay.
I just want you to come into Fast and Furious 7, entering the seventh in a franchise. I just want to know what you think.
Yeah, that might be funny.
All right. We're not going to talk about anything else that's coming out, because why bother? However, welcome to the new streamlined film stage show that we are still currently in an hour and 15 minutes in. So really quick, let's each name something that we watched on our own that we think people should check out. Amanda, you made us do this because you said you had a really good one, so you start us off.
Oh, no, I meant that was for Decline of Western Civilization, but...
Oh, so we don't have to do the other thing.
No, I can. I actually... Jesus. I was so crestfallen over It Follows, so I came home and watched Scanners.
Oh, that's why you were tweeting about that last night. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I've never seen it before. Yeah, I haven't watched a lot of early Cronenberg, but I watched Scanners, and I just... loved it. Okay. And I don't know why I waited so long to watch it. So it's streaming on Hulu Plus. It's the Criterion version. It's pretty great, you guys.
Cool. Danny King.
So I was so, you know, heavily shaken by having to miss our podcast on Run All Night that I watched Chame Coletzera's Orphan, which I hadn't seen before.
How was that?
It's really good. And it's a horror film, so speaking of that. But it's kind of funny because I remember the movie came out, and I mean, I did have no idea who this guy was at the time, but I just read the Wikipedia because it's just like, that's what I felt like doing, I guess, one day. So I watched the movie this time knowing the twist, which was sort of a funny experience. But outside of that, it's Vera Farmiga actually gives an amazing performance. It's like the movie opens with her having a miscarriage, and so the whole movie is sort of weighed down by tragedy. And the horror stuff is very over the top, and he has a lot of fun with that. But there are also a lot of scenes between Vera Farmiga and Peter Sarsgaard that are really serious and intensely acted, and so I think it's quite a good movie.
That's funny because actually last night I watched Nonstop.
Did you really?
Yeah. Yeah, they call a Sarah up in this bitch. That's not what I'm going to talk about, though. We already know how much I love Nonstop. I am going to talk about briefly Across the Universe, directed by Julie Taymor. It's the musical with the Beatle music in the 60s, and I know a lot of people are down on this movie, but I fucking love it. I don't give a shit.
And I like Julie Taymor. I have no interest in that movie.
Have you ever seen it?
No.
Oh.
I hate the Beatles.
What? You can get the fuck out. Good Lord.
What's happening?
Who are you?
Have you seen her version of Titus?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that movie.
Love it.
Sorry. Go ahead, Brian.
It's fine. It's fine. No.
I just like hijacking your recommendations.
Why do you do that?
Because it's so fun.
You fucking monster. All right. So that's it. That's it for today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Let's tell the fine people where you can be found in the meantime between now and next week, when we'll be hitting the button to ignite the nitrous and zoom into Fast 7. Danny King, where can you be found online?
Filmstage.com, Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin, and watching Night Game.
Right now, as we speak?
Yep.
I just started. Yeah, 10 minutes in. No.
Fantastic.
Amanda Waltz.
I am at Media Waltz on Twitter. That's all I'm going to say.
Jesus. You're not going to talk about Steel City Cinema?
Yeah, I guess. I also cover Pittsburgh film culture on Steel Cinema on WordPress.
All right. See, why would you cover that up?
I don't know. Have I now
effectively made you ashamed of
Because you were going to make some Pittsburgh joke.
I feel like I've already made enough for one episode.
I don't want to facilitate you.
All right.
Doing this.
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. Get it? Get it, guys? Follow me.
It follows.
Yeah, exactly. You can also find me on the film stage. And also my personal site, dearfilm.net. And follow me on Letterboxd, because I'm actually doing it now. It's like the third year I've had it, and I'm finally actually trying to make it work.
I think I on every like 6 months. It's like a chore.
I've started getting into it, like just immediately opening it up after I've seen a movie and logging it. Like, I'm down with that. It's difficult. It's been difficult, but I'm doing really well this year. I'm pretty excited, guys. I just did it because I had such a hard time making a top 10 list last year.
You make it sound like you just got out of rehab. Dude, pretty good.
It works if you work it day by day. It's fine.
It's not an addiction.
I don't have a problem. I've logged 35 films so far for 2015.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. That's also just terrifying to watch, because if you assume that each of those was like 2 hours long. What am I doing with my life? Anyway, right, thanks for joining us.
Sit down.
I am sitting down. You think I do podcasts standing up?
You have a standing desk?
It's a walking desk, actually. So thanks for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. And tune in next week. As I said, we will be talking about Fast and Furious 7, Furious 7, the seventh film in the greatest franchise ever.
So, Shelf Factory is coming out with a three disc box set.
No!
How much will you pay me to cut that out of the podcast?
How much would I pay you?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Oh, man.
You can keep it in.
I'm sorry, that was a three what? That was a three what?
Three disc box set. It doesn't take a lot, does it, Brian, to get you going?
Oh, I just love that we just spent like a huge amount of time talking about a movie that its sex is its primary plot point. Nothing like that happens. And now it does. Anyway, go ahead.
So now I got to compose myself. Okay.
Yeah.
Try it again.